Welcome to the Christian Publishing Review, where we take a closer look at new books coming from today's faith culture. In this edition, you'll hear a special interview with Douglas Gresham, the beloved stepson of C.S. Lewis. He has written a duly personal biography of the famous Narnia author entitled Jack's Life, featured recently in USA Today and Time Magazine. And get ready for the holiday season with Josie's Gift, a new children's book from a highly decorated author and illustrator team that declares, "Christmas is not about what we want, but what we have." It all starts right now, here on the Christian Publishing Review. Douglas Gresham was just a boy when his mother, Joy Davidman, moved with her sons from America to England, where they befriended legendary author C.S. Lewis. In time, Davidman and Lewis married, and Jack, as the writer was known, provided his new stepsons with fatherly care. Gresham was uniquely qualified to write a new Lewis biography entitled Jack's Life. He illuminates the everyday charms of a literary icon who was far more than the genius behind the Chronicles of Narnia and Mere Christianity.
Though your stepfather's name was Clive Staples Lewis, nobody ever called him Clive. They all called him Jack. Why was that?
Well, he began one of his books, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, with a deathless line: "There was once a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it." Now, I think if you were born Clive, or christened Clive Staples Lewis, and didn't deserve it, you would probably do something fairly soon to change that, and Jack felt the same way. When he was about four, he was living in Northern Ireland, of course, in Belfast, and in his neighborhood there was a little dog called Jaxie, and Jack had struck up a friendship with this dog. And by some accident, the dog was killed, I think run over by a carriage or a cart or something. There weren't very many motor cars around those days. This would have been very early part of the 20th century. And so Jack came home that day and pointed at himself and said, "He is Jaxie," and would not answer to anything else. He was a very determined little boy. He was about 4 years old. So it became Jaxie, and then Jax, and then later Jack, and it stuck with him for the rest of his life. But it was a much more suitable name for him than Clive, anyway. Clive didn't suit Jack at all.
Speaking of houses, of course, the one that is most closely linked with Lewis is the Kilns in Headington Quarry, just outside of Oxford. What are your early recollections of that house and the occupants, particularly Lewis and his brother Warney?
I first met Jack and Warney in 1953, I think it was. And I was a little boy, 8 years old, straight out of America. I'd read the Narnian Chronicles, and I was a great enthusiast for fantasies and fairy stories and things like that. And coming across from America, to start with, I was a newcomer to England, and everywhere I looked there were castles and ancient houses and things, the sort of thing I'd never seen before in my life. And I guess in my eight-year-old imagination, the man who was a friend of High King Peter of Narnia and closely related with Aslan, the great lion of Narnia, should have been wearing silver armor and carrying a jewel-encrusted sword. And of course, when I first met Jack at the Kilns, we came in through the back door and he came to greet us. And he was the most unlikely-looking fellow I'd ever seen in my life. I'd never seen anyone who even looked remotely like that. He was a stooped, balding, professorial-looking gentleman in very scruffy clothes, with long nicotine-stained teeth and nicotine-stained fingers, because he was a chain-smoker. He just didn't look like anything like anything I could possibly imagine, because I'd never seen anything like it before in my life. And for a few minutes, I was a bit disappointed and a bit almost frightened. And then, of course, Warney was an equally eccentric, to my eyes, character. But these two were members of an almost, even then, almost vanished race. They were 19th century men. And but their personalities and the enormous wealth of compassion and humor in the two of them soon eradicated any disappointment I might have had. They were great guys. They were really very nice men. Warney was one of the great English gentlemen of a bygone era. Unfortunately, he had an alcoholism problem. He was a binge alcoholic. But when he was sober, he was one of God's greatest English gentlemen. And Jack was just an amazingly compassionate, warm, humorous man. This is one of the things that always gets lost in portrayals of Jack in Shadowlands, for example, and the various other places he's been portrayed. That is the humor. You could not be in a room with Jack for more than 5 minutes without roaring with laughter. I mean, he was just hilarious to be with. Great company, a great raconteur, huge wealth of wit, a very sharp, very fast wit. He was an amazing guy. So initially, though, I was disappointed as a little boy. He soon overcame all of that, and so did Warney. I grew to love them very dearly.
Now, Lewis, when writing to someone about your first stay at the Kilns, wrote of two crusty old bachelors, referring to Warney and himself, having to adjust to two American boys with boundless energy, namely you and your brother David. How well did two crusty old bachelors cope with those two boys?
Well, I can only speak for myself. And there are a couple of interesting things about that remark which most people don't pick up on. One is the boundless energy of American boys as opposed to English boys. At the time, we were just after the Second World War, we're in 1953, rationing is still current in England. And it is true to say that American children were better fed at that point of history, much better fed, better nutrition than English boys, and did have more energy and were more excitable and more free-spirited, I suppose. They didn't have the privations that had been hammered into English children throughout the war years and so forth. So yes, we would have been remarkably energetic in comparison to the normal English schoolboy of the same age, 8-year-old or whatever. So that has to be taken into account, that it was a bit of a surprise to Jack and Warney, even compared to the local schoolboys they might know, we would have been somewhat different. But yes, Jack and Warney did actually adapt very well, Jack particularly, and as I say, speaking for myself, he joined in some of my madcap adventures and so forth. And we had a whale of a time, actually. My first visit was, as I say, in 1953, in the winter of that year. And the Kilns itself was the kind of house you don't see in America to start with. It was built mostly as a bunch of afterthoughts thrown together. The kilns themselves, the actual brick kilns, still stood. And there were outbuildings and all kinds of things, and there were just lovely, lovely places for a little boy to explore. To me, it was like being transported to Narnia. And I suddenly began to realize that the characters I was living with in the house were almost Narnian characters themselves.
I have to ask you, was the famous wardrobe there?
Well, you know, people keep talking about the wardrobe. Mm. Well, there wasn't the wardrobe. This is the interesting thing. There was, and still is, a very beautiful wardrobe. It used to stand in the hall just by the kitchen door, which was carved by Jack's grandfather out of black oak, handmade. And it was a lovely piece of furniture and still is, and it's now, I think, in the Wade Center at Wheaton College in Illinois. But it was not the wardrobe that stimulated The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. There never was any specific wardrobe that fulfilled that role. This was just a literary device to get children, in a rather nice way, from one world to another. I mean, people have often used doors and so forth. The idea of going into a wardrobe and finding that the back of it opens into a different world is kind of charming. I like it.
Now, you say in your book that Jack was the most Christian man you knew. What did you actually mean by that?
Well, when I said the most Christian man, he was the man who exhibited his Christianity most openly and practiced it most assiduously. Of all the people I have ever met, I've never met anyone who exceeds him in this. He would catch himself in what he would regard as uncharitable thoughts and correct himself. He would take any action to demonstrate his love for Christ that became available to him, any opportunity. He was a man who didn't only believe in Christ, he believed Christ. I think that's a very important distinction to make. When Jesus said something, Jack believed that he meant it and he knew what he was talking about, as do I. When he told us, for example, to love our enemies, I mean, he doesn't mean sit on a fence somewhere and try to conjure up some sloppy emotion for someone who hates you. He meant to do things, loving things for our enemies, and Jack would put this into practice. Jack put the Christian principles, as taught by Jesus in the Gospels, into everyday, every minute of everyday practice. I don't think I've ever met anyone who did it quite as well as Jack has done. In fact, anyone near as well as Jack did.
2005 will be the 50th anniversary of Lewis's spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy. Are there any small personal things that you can share about your stepfather that you haven't already shared? Things that would be of interest to his readers, perhaps, that weren't even mentioned in Surprised by Joy?
It's a very big question. Most of those would be in my new book. But, you know, it's personal things about Jack. There are things that people have never known and people don't understand. One of those things probably is his fears. We all have our own personal fears, and Jack had his. And funnily enough, several of Jack's personal fears are also paralleled in my being. Jack was somewhat afraid of being left alone in the sense of being left alone without anyone's love. Now, he'd had this happen to him when he was a little boy, when he lost his mother. And his father tried desperately to overcompensated. He tried very hard to compensate for the loss of their mother and made a hash of it, as often happens. And Jack found himself as a child bereft of any loving parent. as he saw it at the time. Now, I think it happened to Jack when he was about nine, in a sense. His father was a distant, authoritarian figure, and suddenly there was no one. No one to reach out to. And I think that fear lasted, in a small degree, with Jack for the rest of his life, as it will with me. It's the kind of thing, these things that are hammered into us in early childhood, you can never absolutely shake them. Though, of course, you can overcome them, but you can't shake the existence of them. So that fear stayed with Jack, and I think probably my mother's impending death was very difficult for him. And then, her eventual demise knocked him sideways, as we know from A Grief Observed.
Of course, there have been many biographies written about Lewis, and as one who is extremely close to him, I'm wondering why you never wrote this biography before. And what do you think this biography of yours will contribute to the literature that has been written about Jack?
There are very qualified men who have written biographies of Jack. And to be honest, they've all disappointed me. I think the only one that doesn't is George Sayers' book, Jack, C.S. Lewis and His Times, which is an excellent piece. And George is a very fine man, and I've known him for many, many years. I like him enormously. He wrote an honest approach to Jack's life, but they're all what I would describe as critical biographies. These are biographies that concentrate more on the work and how it came about. And as soon as you start trying to say how a writer thought and explain by that how he wrote and why he wrote, what he wrote and where the philosophy came from, I think you're in very dangerous waters. But no one has actually written about Jack as a man and pointed out that he was a good man, an enormously courageous man, and a very wise man. And also, I think, very few people have dared, perhaps, to point out that although Jack wrote all the words down, the author of his books was the Holy Spirit of God, because he was a man committed to God and to the Holy Spirit of God. And I think that's an important thing that's been overlooked, or perhaps deliberately left out of many of the works. I think it's important that people have a chance just to get to know the guy, as I did. Mm. It was an enormous, looking back on it, it was an enormous privilege, in a sense, to be brought up by C.S. Lewis and Warney. At the time, it was just my childhood. I mean, people say, what was it like? And I have to admit I have nothing to compare it with, so I can't really draw any comparisons or describe what it was like growing up with C.S. Lewis. It was just the way things were. But looking back on it, yes, it was an enormous privilege. And if I can share a little bit of that privilege with other people by writing this book and publishing it, I'm happy to do so. Also, I think that I get enormous numbers of letters from kids of all ages, from, you know, about five onwards up, with, you know, in the teenagers and then in the 20s, asking about him as a man. People are interested in who he was and what sort of man he was. Because I think they're beginning to understand, after the movie Shadowlands and the play Shadowlands, with which you're well familiar, and all the works written about him, that this man was not just your run-of-the-mill literature professor. There was something exceptional about him. And people are interested in him as a man. And I think that without glorifying him in any way, it's important that people realize, or get a chance to realize, what a wonderful guy he was.
That was Douglas Gresham, stepson of C.S. Lewis, discussing Jack's life, his new biography of the Narnia Bard, here on the Christian Publishing Review. Learn more about Jack's life and other Lewis-related books at broadmanholman.com/C.S. Lewis. Just in time for this holiday season, a new children's book, Josie's Gift, tells the story of a Depression-era girl who learns the true meaning of Christmas thanks to three surprise visitors and an even more surprising sacrificial gift. Lavishly illustrated by Frank Ordaz, who worked on Academy Award-winning films at George Lucas's Industrial Light and Magic, and written by People's Choice Award nominee Kathleen Bostrom, Josie's Gift is sure to carve a special place in every reader's heart. Listen now to a reading from Josie's Gift, available at meetjosie.com.
Josie knew exactly what she wanted for Christmas that year, the first Christmas after Papa died. She knew as deep down sure as a person could get that this was the one gift she absolutely had to have. Josie would never forget the day she saw the blue sweater. The crisp October air made Josie's cheeks turn pink as she rode into town with Mama and her little brother Bobby Joe on their weekly shopping trip. Garden patches spilled over with plump orange pumpkins. Josie took deep breaths and could almost smell the spicy pies she and Mama would be baking soon with some of those pumpkins. While Mama did her shopping at the Five and Dime, Josie wandered next door to check out the window display of her favorite clothing store. Usually, she contented herself with just looking at the elegant clothes, some with sequins that sparkled like rubies and emeralds. She knew her family would never be able to afford such luxuries. Still, Josie dreamed about wearing the fancy dresses with purses to match. She tilted her head as if she were wearing a hat with silk flowers stitched to its sweeping brim. She closed her eyes and pretended to dance in the spike-heeled shoes that came in every color of the rainbow. But on that fall day, when Josie peeked in the window of the store, there it was, a sweater, blue as the blue of the summer sky, blue as Josie's eyes, the prettiest blue she'd ever seen in all her life. "Why, it's just so beautiful," she sighed, staring at the blue sweater draped gracefully against sparkling white tissue paper. She counted 12 shimmering pearl-white buttons down the front of the sweater and reached her hand to the window as if she could feel the softness of the fine knit through the glass. Every week after that, when Mama, Josie, and Bobby Joe made their trip to town, Josie stopped in front of the shop window so she could gaze at the blue sweater. "Mama," Josie announced to her mother in the kitchen one day, "I know what I want for Christmas." Josie's mother pushed her rolling pin back and forth across a mound of pie dough with her sleeves rolled up. Without missing a beat, she said to Josie, "And what would that be, Josie girl?" Josie winced at the nickname her papa had pinned on her back when she was younger than Bobby Joe was now. It was Papa's special name for her. "Josie girl," Papa would say as she tagged along on his chores, "hand me that milk bucket." Or, "Josie girl, now you be careful near those hogs or you'll be swimming in their supper." It just didn't sound the same coming from Mama. "Mama, you know that blue sweater in the dress shop window? Why, it's the prettiest thing I've ever seen. It has 12 pearl-white buttons. 12, Mama. If I can have that sweater for Christmas, I promise I'll never ask for anything again." Mama stopped her rolling. "Now, Josie girl, don't you go making promises you can't keep." "But, Mama, I mean it. This sweater is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, and I don't ask for much, and I never wanted anything more in my life. Mama, please." Mama dusted the flower from her hands and brushed a loose strand of hair from her eyes. "I know it's a lovely sweater, Josie," she sighed, "but we can't afford things like that. You know there's a depression going on. With Papa gone, why, it's all I can do to keep this farm going and everyone fed." Mama pushed the rolling pin through the dough a little harder than before. "I'm sorry, Josie girl." Even though Josie knew her mother was truly sorry, she ran from the room without a word. Tucked into bed that night, Josie thought about the Christmases they'd had when Papa was alive. On Christmas Eve, they would all go to church. Everyone got a small unlit candle when they came in the door. At the end of the service, the pastor lit a tall white candle called the Christ candle. One by one, each person in the church lit their candle from the Christ candle until the whole church glowed. And they all sang Silent Night and Joy to the World, and Josie's spirit swelled with such happiness that she felt full to the brim. Back home, Papa always lit a fire, while Mama made steaming mugs of hot chocolate and buttered bread with brown sugar and cinnamon, a special treat. Then, Papa took a carved wooden box from the cedar chest and set it carefully on the fireplace while the two children sat waiting. Bobby Joe nearly jumped out of his skin with excitement. Papa lifted the lid on the box, then reached inside. Tenderly, he lifted the little figures wrapped in soft scraps of cloth. Every year, Papa carved a wooden figure for the nativity he started on Josie's first Christmas. First, he carved Mary. The next year, Joseph. And when Josie turned 3, a tiny wooden manger and a baby appeared in the nativity on Christmas morning. The year Josie was 4 and Bobby Joe was born, Papa added a shepherd. Soon, the nativity included Mary and Joseph, the baby, one shepherd, 2 sheep, a wise man, and a cow. It became a guessing game, wondering what figure Papa would carve next. On Christmas Eve, as the children set out the wooden pieces on the slate hearth by the fireplace, Papa and Josie had fun remembering the order in which the pieces had been carved. "Mary was the first," Papa said. "Then came Joseph," said Josie. "Next came the baby Jesus. And then the shepherd and the sheep?" "Not fair, Josie girl," Papa laughed. "You got to count two."
"You can count two next," Josie smiled.
"Okay," said Papa. "The wise man and the cow."
Bobby Joe looked puzzled. "Did the wise man ride on a cow?"
Papa whisked Bobby Joe into his arms and whirled him around, tickling the little boy's face with his rough beard. "Yes, that's it, Bobby Joe." Papa's hearty laugh filled the room. "The wise man rode to Bethlehem on a cow." That year, Papa added a camel to the growing crowd gathered around the baby Jesus. After all the figures were in place, Papa settled into his big chair near the fire. Bobby Joe snuggled under one of Papa's big, strong arms, while Josie tucked herself under the other. Mama rocked next to them in the chair Papa had made for her when Josie was born. Papa had a saying. "Remember," he said every year, "Christmas is not about what we want. It's about what we have." Then he'd kiss both children on the forehead. They'd sit by the fire until Josie and Bobby Joe fell asleep, and Papa carried them to bed. But that spring, Papa died of the fever, and Josie knew that nothing would ever be the same.
That's a reading from Josie's Gift, a new holiday book for children ages 4 to 8. Look inside this beautifully illustrated treasure and hear the entire audio reading at meetjosie.com. You've been listening to the Christian Publishing Review, sponsored by Broadman and Holman Publishers. Learn more online at broadmanholman.com. And thanks so much for joining us.